The court calls U.S. v. Gutierrez, and we invite counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of this court. My name is Kevin McDermott, along with Captain Mike Estrada. We represent Tech Sergeant David Gutierrez, the appellant in this case. I also want to acknowledge Captain Daniel Shoney, his predecessor, who was instrumental in putting the briefs together in this case. As the court may recall, we were actually on your docket this time last year. Having been a member of this bar for over 30 years, I'm honored I am to be here for the first time to give this opportunity to be able to talk to you today. And Judge Baker, with your permission, may I proceed?
Of course.
Thank you. This court granted issues in three areas for discussion today. Whether the evidence was legally insufficient to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant committed assault likely to result in grievous bodily injury. Number two, whether the evidence was legally sufficient to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant committed adultery. And finally, whether the facially unreasonable delay in post-trial processing deprived the element appellant of his due process rights to speedy review under Miranda. Now, we have no illusions as to the real issue that we're here for, having to do with issue number one, and that being the assault likely to result in grievous bodily harm. Again, the issue having been an appellate with HIV. At the turn of the last century, there was a plague that afflicted 35 to 40% of everyone who came in contact with it, that had a death rate well in excess of 50%. And it was something in which our populace rose to the occasion to outlaw individuals from having sex with this particular affliction. This affliction, by the 1930s and 1940s, was subdued because of the invention and the discovery of sulfa drugs and antibiotics. We're talking about syphilis. Now, I am not equating HIV and syphilis in the same ballpark. What I am trying to convince the court, though, is the fact that we have evolved in the last 25 years since Joseph as to our understanding of exactly what HIV is and what AIDS can become. And I believe it's important in this court to understand the evolution that has taken place in the last 25 years relative to our understanding of what HIV is and what HIV can become, and what we can, in fact, anticipate the potential of passing this disease along. Now, as Weatherspoon points out, I'm not here to argue that HIV is not a dangerous and deadly outcome of sex. What I am here to argue is that first prong.
Can you just put that into the terms of the element in question? So in your view, this is a case about likely.
Yes, sir.
But you're not here to argue it's not a case about, or it is a case about, grievous bodily harm.
No, sir. I would have loved to have had that opportunity at the trial level, but it didn't resolve that way. So I'm here left with that prong as to the likelihood. And this court, having reviewed the transcript.
And do you agree that this is a case, at this point in time, on appeal about the meaning of that element?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And to put it in context, as the record bears out, this particular situation had a singular expert testify at trial. Dr. Donna Swee, who headed up the state of Kansas's HIV intervention program, and the testimony at trial indicated that it was 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 100,000 opportunity that David Gutierrez could pass HIV off to an individual that he was having sex with. Now, to put this in context, that would mean David Gutierrez would have had to have sex four times a day, every day for 8 years, or 40 times a day, every day for 8 years.
Where did the 1 in 500 come from?
You know, I honestly don't know. I think the record is pretty clear. If you look at page 183 of the record, this is the cross-examination of the trial counsel in this particular case. Dr. Swoop makes it very clear, 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 100,000. Now, where the confusion may come in, gentlemen and men, is earlier in the testimony regarding what we call viral loads. Now, Dr. Sweet testified in direct that David Gutierrez's viral load was between 1,300 and 1,500. Her opinion was, at that time and still is, that for him to be infectious to a reasonable certainty, which was up to 25%, was his viral load needed to be 45 to 50,000. Now, we're not saying that each and every case of somebody being HIV positive is not a likelihood of committing grievous bodily injury. But what we're saying in the facts of this case is that because of the statistical probabilities opined by the expert for the government, David Gutierrez had virtually no chance of passing along the HIV.
Does that mean you're not here to argue that the test should be a numerical test or a math test?
I think it needs to be a factual examination of the evidence presented at trial.
So that suggests that in a different HIV case with different viral loads and different facts, you might argue the element might apply differently, or that this element can never apply in the context of an HIV-positive case?
No, sir. I would never argue that. I believe that the circumstances presented in this case is the circumstance in which the court should run with as far as setting a standard. That if the evidence boils down at trial, that the statistical probability is slim enough, then the likelihood should disappear.
Well, counsel,
if, in fact, the evidence points different, that there's a much higher count and there's a much higher probability of infection, that is for the, I would believe, maybe the first and foremost, for the trial judge to determine whether or not it reaches a certain level of threshold, and then for the trial defense. Yes, ma'am.
Judge Ryan.
Is it your view, given the standard of review we have in this case, which is legal sufficiency, that there's a difference between the unprotected vaginal intercourse and the protected vaginal intercourse and the evidence that was adduced as to the likelihood of harm from either?
That's one of those questions in the evidence in this case that I thought was rather unusual. You have to understand that the government order in this case told David Gutierrez, don't have sex without informing your partner, and don't have sex unless you use a prophylactic or a condom. What that tells me is the government actually sanctions sex with a condom.
That's not my question, counsel. My question is with respect to legal sufficiency.
Yes.
Right? The evidence, as I understood it, was that for unprotected vaginal intercourse, that the expert testified that the chances of infection were 1 in 500, whereas with respect to the protected vaginal intercourse, she testified that the chances of infection were 3 per 50,000 and said it was only, quote, remotely possible. So what I'm asking you is, given the legal standard, in your view, is there any difference in terms of legal sufficiency of the offense with respect to the unprotected vaginal intercourse as opposed to the protected vaginal intercourse?
I would believe there's an absolute difference. And in fact, I believe the trial judge actually viewed it in that manner. If, in fact, the evidence pointed out that prophylactics were used, those particular offenses were dismissed or found not guilty. Certainly there is a difference between protected and unprotected. And again, that dovetails with the standing order that Gutierrez had. You wouldn't expect the government to actually issue an order exposing individuals to HIV if, in fact, they thought prophylactic use was not somehow sufficient to prevent that from happening.
May I follow up then? Did I understand you to say there's a difference between a 1 in 10,000 possibility and a 1 in 500 possibility for the purposes of interpreting the legal sufficiency standard and the element here?
Sir, I again would point the court's attention to the record of trial at page 183. Protected oral had zero chance of spreading. Unprotected vaginal, with my client's count at the time, was 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 100,000 chance of transmission. Page 183 of the record of trial. It seems clear to me that Dr. Sweet was discussing the opportunity of transmitting this virus based upon unprotected sex, based upon his particular viral load at the time.
Can I try a hypothetical on you?
Please.
I go out to celebrate some event, and I fire a weapon in the air. And it turns out that what goes up must come down, and in some countries and locations, people end up dying every year because they get hit by celebratory rounds. If I said that there was a 1 in 100,000 chance that one of those rounds is going to come down and hit one of us, but it's a weapon, it's an AK-47, how would you apply the law to that in terms of likely?
This is akin to, are you pointing a gun in the air in the middle of a crowded street in a city, or are you standing on a boat in the middle of a lake pulling a trigger? The substantial likelihood of harming somebody is not an issue. That bullet hits somebody, it's going to hurt. It's going to cause grievous bodily injury. But that's not the only prong of Weatherspoon. The other prong is, did I do it in under a circumstance in which there's a great likelihood that it's going to actually hit somebody? So the question needs to be begged, am I standing on a boat, or am I standing on the street corner of downtown Washington, D.C.? And in this particular circumstance, based upon his viral load and based upon the evidence provided by Dr. Sweet, he's on a boat in the middle of the Potomac pulling that trigger.
Counsel, is it inaccurate or an oversimplification to say that you're arguing a totality of the circumstances?
We are.
Then can you articulate what this court should look at and what guidance we should give to prosecutors, military judge, yes, CCA, about what circumstances we are talking about?
I would invite the court to perhaps, this is not a bright line case. This is truly the factual totality of the circumstances in which experts and examination by the trial judge and the panel has to determine whether or not this is a viral load sufficient. Obviously, there wouldn't be any particular argument at this point if David Gutierrez had a viral load of 60,000 and Dr. Sweet testified that he had a 1 in 3 chance of passing it. We wouldn't be here. We're here because...
Okay, but beyond viral load, what other things should we give for guidance about what should be...
Another thing may have to do with what we call CD4 count. This has to do with type of antibiotic protection that your immunity protection that your body has. There is ways to judge whether or not somebody's body is fully functioning immunologically to determine whether or not you're fighting off a particular virus.
So are you referring there to the person who has HIV or the sexual partner?
The person who has HIV, page 170.
Okay, but even with that, if a person, even if that individual is capable of suppressing,
yes,
they can still transmit.
There's an argument and a basis at page 170 of the record of trial with Dr. Sweet again. The higher the CD4 count, the less likelihood you have of passing because your body is actively fighting any kind of bacteria and viruses that it has in the bloodstream.
So is it your position then that in this instance, the expert did not consider a viral load and CD4 count and so forth?
She considered his sufficiently healthy enough to where he probably could not pass along the HIV virus. His CD4 count was high enough, his viral count was low enough to the point where his potential of passing that virus along was basically slim to none.
So the expert here considered the two points that you just raised.
Yes, it was the evidence in case in chief as to the CD4 count that was provided by Dr. Sweet. It was the statistical analysis that she provided in cross examination. And it all is contained in about 37 minutes worth of transcript involving Dr. Sweet. And again, she provides the basis. And I think it would provide the basis for this court.
Okay, but then if we in fact had that occur in this case,
right,
aren't we down to drawing arbitrary lines? You referred to a 1 in 3 chance. You said, I wouldn't be arguing this issue.
Right.
But and where would we draw that line?
And again, I don't believe there would be a bright line other than we have in the law developed certain bright line cutoffs. We presume that somebody is under the influence and unable to operate a vehicle properly in most states with your 0.08 blood alcohol. So we can reach that level. It may take us a little time to work specifically at it.
But that's statutorily imposed. That's not imposed.
I know. It's true. Judicially, the basis here should very well be an expert coming across and being able to testify that the statistical probability should be something akin to maybe 1 in 100, maybe one in 25 time opportunity to be able to pass this along. But I think the test can truly boil down to the expert on behalf of both the government and defense being able to testify as to whether or not this individual has a healthy immune system, has a healthy CD4 count, has a high viral load count, and whether or not that can be statistically paired with the opportunity to pass it along to somebody else.
I have two questions. One is, what's wrong with the plain English definition of likely? It's a neutral question.
No, it is. It is. It boils back to our pulling the trigger of a gun, and it really boils down to likely can be interpreted based upon the circumstances. It's always been that way.
So you're suggesting that sounds more like a factual argument. Is there anything wrong with the plain English definition of likely?
No, I won't contend that it is.
Can you please provide one?
Likely? Again, under these circumstances, likely would be the expert offering an opinion far different than what we had in this case.
I'm not sure I'll find that in the dictionary. Here's another question, just to follow up the same thing.
Please.
Should likely mean different things in different contexts? There's one statute, the element provides likely. Should likely mean one thing in a case of a knife, and one thing in the case of a 45, and one thing in the case of a shotgun, and one thing in the case of a communicable disease, and one thing in the case of something else?
It should, because of the application of each one of those. We pull the trigger. We plunge the knife. We engage in sexual conduct that may or may not.
What's your answer to the question? We should apply one definition, or we should apply different definitions?
I believe under the HIV tests that we're looking at right now, there should be a slightly different analysis.
The problem, to follow up on Judge Olson, this sounds like it's a question for the legislature. It doesn't sound like, here we are, we're sitting here as judges saying, well, 1 in 25 is legally sufficient and 1 in 100 is not legally sufficient, especially given the very elastic standard for legal sufficiency.
Sure.
What should we do here?
It was, I think, important for the court to consider the process that's going on right now with HIV testing and HIV understanding. And I believe that there can be a standard put together in this circumstance.
Is there evidence of record for that?
There is, sir. And to be frank, the trial counsel underneath didn't necessarily object to the analysis and did not object to the court at that particular point in time. But I think under the sufficiency of the evidence test that we apply as to evidence, this is a circumstance in which it's right for a court to step in and apply some sort of reasonable application.
Okay, we're going to go back, counsel, to the question that I asked you before.
Yes.
Okay, which is with respect to unprotected vaginal intercourse. The accused was found guilty of those offenses.
Yes.
Right? Oral sodomy and unprotected oral sodomy and vaginal intercourse.
Yes, ma'am.
And the 1 in 500 possibility. Okay? There's testimony in the record of that. On the other hand, there's testimony with respect to protected vaginal intercourse. And he was found guilty of protected vaginal intercourse. He was found not guilty of the protected oral sodomy. All right? There, they said there's testimony that was only remotely possible because it was 3 per 50,000.
Right.
Why isn't there a difference between those when the standard is whether taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, whether a reasonable finder of fact could find them guilty?
Right. This is.
I mean, I understand you want us to go into viral loads and this, that, and the other.
Right.
I'm saying we're stuck with the record
right. And
the evidence that was there. So there's that evidence with respect to two different types of conduct.
Right.
Why or why not isn't there a difference?
This, and under this particular circumstance.
And I mean, I understand there's other facts in the record,
yes,
right? But we're looking at these facts that were presented to the members.
Right.
Why, based on testimony that there was a 1 in 500 chance, couldn't a member reasonably find that there was more than a remote or speculative possibility of harm, as compared to when there's testimony that it's only remotely possible because it's a 3 in 50,000 chance?
Right.
We could find that was too speculative.
Right. And again, I would argue the court, the circumstances would specifically depend upon the underlying circumstances in which maybe the sex was engaged or how it was conducted. I think what's important to note here is that David Gutierrez had relations with individuals that at the time and place and substance of what was occurring, he had virtually little or no capability of passing along that virus. And that's from a factual understanding, and I believe for future reference, what we need to fashion is an understanding that a physician coming in and saying that there's a greater likelihood, there's an absolute likelihood, there's something more than just fanciful, one in a whatever shot, is required more in order to sustain a conviction under these circumstances.
Please.
Judge Stuckey.
Well,
no.
I have one. Very briefly.
Sure.
On the adultery, on issue two.
Yes.
There's an order telling him not to do this.
Yes.
There's a military order telling him not to do this. Isn't that enough to take it out of Lawrence and throw it into the third prong of Markham, and that's the end of it?
It might, and I'm not necessarily sold that the adultery argument is one of our best here today anyway.
That's enough. Thank you.
Counsel, in regard to issue one, would you concede or contest that a lesser-included offense would still lie here?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You would concede.
Well, and I had that basis until I actually read something yesterday by a blogger regarding whether or not this was fraud in the fact, vice fraud in the inducement, as far as engaging in relations. And really, the argument might be is that when you engage with someone else, it's actually taking on their history, irrespective of what they may tell you their history is. This is not David Gutierrez talking people into sex because he claimed to be a doctor and he was going to perform an examination. These were adults who decided that having sex with other people in a group formation was...
Were you referring to simple assault, or were you referring to...
Assault consummated by battery or something like that.
And I think that's where it may eventually boil down to. It does. And as to, just real quick, that the last issue is what I've been kind of describing as the cat catching its tail kind of circumstances. But here under Moreno, we would need to find some other issue that the court agrees requiring relief in order to allow Moreno to kick in. We've provided in our briefs what we think the appropriate resolution should be under the circumstances.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have time on rebuttal. We'll restore some time if need be, so long as there's questions. Counsel for the government, please.
Judge Baker, honorable judges of the school, may it please the court, Major Brian Mason, Colonel Catherine Oler, I represent the United States in this interview. Now, the appellant, as an NCO in the United States Air Force, took the lives of seven women in his hands and knowingly exposed them to his deadly, incurable disease, HIV. For that, he was properly convicted of his crimes. I'd like to talk first about issue one, the aggravated assault offenses. I think it's very important.
Can you hear on the back? Okay, sorry about that. I was having a little bit of trouble hearing, so I pretended it was the back I was worried about.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I'll speak up. Thank you very much. I think it's important to look at this case through what we all are familiar with, the legal sufficiency standard, and remember the importance of applying that correct standard. Because looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, applying that standard as the Supreme Court set forth in Jackson, it's clear that the military judge, acting as fact finder in this case, rationally, reasonably relied on the evidence in front of him to find the appellant guilty of all of these offenses.
You would agree that the issue in this case is whether that element is met with regard to likely?
Yes, Your Honor. That seems to be the crux of appellant's appeal.
And what does the government posit is the test or the meaning of what likely means?
Well, Your Honor, as this court stated in United States v. Joseph, the test is whether or not, because he has HIV, we know from the second element, from the case law, from the evidence here, really the focus is on likelihood refers to likelihood of death or grievous bodily harm if the disease enters the body. And then we take a look at, of course, whether...
So the event itself does not have to be likely in the government's perspective?
Well, Your Honor, the second part of that is the likelihood need be only over merely fanciful, speculative, or remote. That's what this court has repeatedly stated.
And you're getting that from Joseph?
From Joseph, Your Honor, and also is reiterated by this court's opinion in Dawkins.
But is it fair to say that fanciful and likely are not necessarily synonyms?
I'd agree with that, Your Honor.
If one were to apply a plain English definition to likely, is that an appropriate way to interpret the term? Is that a place to start if the statute itself doesn't provide a definition?
Well, as this court stated in Weatherspoon, Your Honor, the Weatherspoon really set forth the standard we need to take a look at. And I don't think there's any reason to make any change in the law as we are. I mean, this has been the case for since this court came out with the Joseph decision over 20 years ago. And Judge Stuckey, as you mentioned earlier, you know, isn't this a question for the legislature? The Congress has had Joseph out and published decision for decades. If Congress wanted to make a change for our application of HIV prosecutions, they could have done so. So the government's position is there's no reason to make any changes to the application of the laws. We already have it.
Should the law apply in equal manner to different types of assaults?
Absolutely.
The gun, knife, bat. So the government would say that the correct test in all those is fanciful or first let's do the equal part. So whatever the test is, it should apply equally. There shouldn't be an HIV version of likely, a gun version of likely, and so on.
Yes,
the government agrees with that.
As the court stated correctly, I believe, in Weatherspoon, the test for aggravated assaults is the same for all the cases. Doesn't make it necessary. There's no reason to make it necessarily a distinction just for HIV cases. Now, we have a line of cases in the HIV prosecutions, and the test is, as the court should apply, is the same as it's already set out. So the first question is whether or not it is likely that a person would suffer grievous bodily harm or death if the disease enters the body. And here the evidence is...
So you don't think the chances that the disease would enter the body have any bearing on the equation?
No, Your Honor. I'm not trying to argue that. I don't think that's the correct analysis. I think the correct analysis is what the court has stated, saying that it need only be more than a fanciful, speculative, or remote possibility.
So we use likely in one manner for grievous bodily harm, but different for whether it's going to occur or not. One is fanciful and the other is likely.
Well, I think the way that my interpretation of the court's opinions is, okay, so we have this test of likelihood, focusing on the result of the harm as a result of the disease entering the body. So we have that in terms of the likelihood. But then we have sort of this minimum threshold, as the way I would articulate it, of, okay, well, the transmission rate needs to be more than merely fanciful, speculative, remote. That should be the bottom line.
Well, and what's fanciful and remote? Is 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000 fanciful and remote? It may not be fanciful. It certainly sounds remote.
Well, as the court stated, it's merely fanciful, speculative, or remote. So that should be that floor. Now, what that is statistically, Your Honor, as you know, Judge Ryan, you articulated in your concurring opinion in Dawkins, I can't stand here and presume to know where those are. What I can say is 1 in 500 chance of transmission rate is not fanciful or remote. And I believe there was a question earlier about where that necessarily came from. I believe, Chief Judge Baker, that may have been your question. The first statistic, and it's important to remember that Dr. Sweet's testimony, she gave three statistics. The first one out of her testimony, Joint Appendix, I believe 201. Yes, Joint Appendix 201, right at the bottom of the page. She's talked about it's somewhere between 10 and 20 positives per 10,000 encounters. That was the first statistic she gave. So looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, which of course we have to do at this point.
And that's for unprotected vaginal intercourse, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. So we'd reduce that down to one positive per 500 exposures. That's where the one in 500 came from. If I did my math wrong, let me know, please, but I think we're good on that. One in 500.
Well, then where did the one in 10,000, the one in 100,000 come from?
In the testimony, Your Honor, she did talk about, on the next page, Joint Appendix 202, at the end, she says, so again, that's why those numbers are skewed. Somewhere between 1 in 10 per 10,000 exposures would become infected. Then later, in cross-examination, at Joint Appendix at page 206, defense counsel asked sort of a compound question there. Talked about protected oral, unprotected oral, and then unprotected vaginal all into one question. And defense counsel asked, talked with regards to the unprotected vaginal, you said roughly 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 100,000 for sexual act. And the expert responded, yes, sir.
That's unprotected?
Correct, Your Honor. So where we are here on the appeal, applying legal sufficiency standard, could the military judge, sitting as a rational fact finder in this case, rely on the first statistic that she gave, which was between 10 and 20 positives per 10,000?
Let's talk about the third statistic.
Yes, Your Honor.
For the protected vaginal.
Your Honor, as I was listening to appellant's counsel's argument, I heard Your Honor mention...
3 for 50,000 in testimony that was remotely possible.
Yes, Your Honor. If we look at the Joint Appendix on page 207, I see the testimony about remotely possible. I'm not familiar and don't remember a statistic of 3 in 50,000 from this record. So, and I may have just missed it, Your Honor, but as I listened to the appellant's argument and your questions, I don't remember that being part of this record with regards to the 50,000.
I'm still struggling with how you get, not you, but I mean, you're citing Joseph, but how does one get not speculative or remote from likely?
Well, Your Honor, what we're doing is applying...
If I'm buying a lottery ticket or something and someone says it's not speculative you'll win, I mean, if they say likely, I think I got a pretty good shot of winning.
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question.
And go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's a question, too. I just... Because you're living with our case, so
yes, Your Honor,
please respond in an appropriate way.
And I'm glad you bring up that analogy. Because when we're talking about winning the lottery or catching something like Ebola or those kinds of things, you know, those are clearly fanciful, speculative, remote type circumstances.
Not if you're not Sierra Leone.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's a great point. But if we're sitting here in the middle of D.C., where we don't have individuals like that around, at least that we're aware of, we're talking about a speculative possibility. But we're talking about getting in bed with the appellant and engaging in sexual intercourse, who's HIV positive, knows it, and you know where the expert's testifying and looking at the evidence.
But nobody's saying that's not criminal. The question is, or the appeal is not on the orders violation and so on. The question is, if it's criminal, under what statute? And the statute the government has chosen is the one that uses the word likely.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, counsel, to build on the chief's question, can you point to a non-HIV case that you believe is most analogous to this aggravated assault charge, either within the CCAs or before this court? Or has the court system come up with a distinct set of case law for HIV cases?
Well, Your Honor, there has been a lot of HIV cases that has established this, as we talked about in our brief. We're talking about Johnson and Joseph and Clark.
Right. So my point is, what can you point to that it's most analogous where an aggravated assault charge lies that is non-HIV?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the first that we need to take a look at is the Weatherspoon case, because the Weatherspoon case talks about the standard. And I forget if it's the Joseph case or if it's the Bygrave case that actually builds on that and draws the analogy of similar to the one I believe Chief Judge Baker you're talking about in your or asking the appellant's counsel during their presentation. You know, if an individual fires a rifle bullet in the air, talking about likelihood, we're talking about the likelihood that a person would suffer grievous bodily harm or death if the bullet hits them. Now,
well, hang on. Just first ask this question. Are there any cases you can cite to, though? I think your question is,
yes.
Do you have any cases, for example?
Not hypotheticals.
The car speeding off from the bar, the person shoots at the car with a 45, but the car is 800 yards away. So if they get hit by the bullet, it's not going to be great, but the chances of getting hit with a 45 at that range is pretty slim. That would be an example where the likelihood of it happening is low, but the likely damage is high.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
So is there a case, do we have cases that we have, non-HIV, like that?
Right. Not in my research, Your Honor. I'd be happy to do some more and provide a supplemental citation.
But basically, you've got HIV case and you've got everything else. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've got lepers over here and we've got everybody else.
Understood,
Your Honor. In the medieval sense.
And Counsel, I apologize. The number 350,000 was created by my law clerk using the calculation that the expert had. So I will, she's very smart, so I will stick by her.
Is it the government's view that the law should be different depending on the nature of the assault vehicle?
I'm sorry.
That there should be HIV meaning a likely and gun meaning a likely and knife meaning a likely?
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't think there needs to be. I think the
I mean, what is the principle of law at stake? I mean, isn't it true that generally the law should apply equally to all persons and you don't have, like, the murder statute means this? You follow?
I do, Your Honor, okay. And I agree. And I don't think there needs to be a difference. And in fact, I think if we apply the laws that this court set out in Weatherspoon, there doesn't shouldn't be a difference. I don't think there needs
so
to be.
So you're not pushing back on that principle?
No, Your Honor, not at all. All I'm asking this court to do is apply the precedent that's been set out for decades by the court and predecessor court. That's all I'm asking this court to do.
Can I just ask how using that precedent, testimony and a calculation that yields only a remote possibility of harm, like only a remote possibility of infection, even though the harm would be great. Everyone concedes that the harm would be great.
Yes, sir.
But remote possibility of infection and a calculation that I will say is 350,000. How is that likely?
We are.
Do you understand? I'm asking the same question as I asked appellant's counsel, which is, in your view, in the government's view, and I'm not asking you to concede, but do you agree that it would be reasonable to draw a distinction between protected and unprotected vaginal intercourse?
Well, Your Honor,
in terms of the statistics that we have to work with from this case.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely understood. Well, certainly there are different things to consider. What I'd emphasize, though, is my guess, Your Honor, is your clerk's calculation was based on the test
formula that the expert gave.
Yes, Your Honor. When she talked about the effectiveness of condom use, and that can be found at Joint Appendix page 200.
Do you have any evidence in the record that shows that there was a likelihood greater than that? That there was a likelihood greater than remote possibility for protected vaginal intercourse?
No, Your Honor. I think that's an accurate statement based on the evidence that we have in front. The question, though, is that is reliant on the effective use of the condoms. And as we saw in use of the
Do you have any evidence that there was ineffective use of condoms in this case?
Well, Your Honor, to answer your question,
okay.
We don't have evidence.
So who cares?
Well, the evidence that we have, Your Honor, is applying the evidence we have, which is condom is not necessarily protective of an individual because it has to be used right against breakage. And we also have evidence, Your Honor, that the expert testified to that an individual, like one of these women, would not recognize that.
I mean, counsel, building on the same hypothetical that the chief judge used, if someone was charged with shooting a gun at a moving vehicle, that there was only a remote possibility that it could possibly even hit the car, let alone hit the individual in the car, let alone hit them in any meaningful manner, do you really think that they would be able to be charged or they would be legally sufficient for a assault with a means likely to result in grievous bodily harm?
Well, Your Honor, I think it depends on not only that evidence, but what other evidence is available. And I think it's important also to recognize...
Well, I mean, it sounds like all the things you think it's important for us to recognize have to do with this particular means. And I wonder why that is.
Well, Your Honor, this is the record that we have in front. That's what I'm prepared to talk about.
Well, the ultimate question here is, have advances in virology, have advances in the understanding of how this disease and this virus work, obviated the factual necessity for the standard that was set out?
Your Honor, you bring up a good question and one that I definitely want to address, because if we
please address it.
If we look at U.S. v. Joseph in that case and the facts that were...
And what's the date on Joseph?
Sorry, Your Honor?
What's the date on Joseph?
That was early 90s, Your
yeah,
Honor.
Yeah, 93, isn't it?
Yes, Your
okay,
Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
So then we look at the facts of this record. And it's important when I say this record, not the facts that appellant's counsel submitted in clemency and wants to submit for...
No, I'm not concerned with post-trial efforts to supplement the record.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. So the facts are really not that different from what we have there and here. When we talk about advances and those kinds of things, certainly there's other medications that are available and those things, and the expert talked about that. But she also talked about the barriers to individuals actually being able to use those, continuing to use those, reasons why they stopped. So we can't take...
Is it the government's contention that, in fact, science and virology hasn't advanced that far since Joseph?
That's not my contention, Your Honor.
Well, that's what you seem to be saying.
My contention is, Your Honor, that the law should not change because a person who has a lot of money and can tolerate side effects and can resist this pill fatigue that the judge talked about, that a person who can meet all those leaps now will be able to live with HIV for the rest of their life. We still have a deadly, incurable disease.
That's the grievous bodily harm side, which I heard appellant concede.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But if we're talking about advances in science, and
okay.
Medicine, absolutely.
Well, I'm talking about advances in... Not in how the things transmit, in knowledge of how things transmitted, and the likelihood that it is transmitted, and so forth.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Understood. Now, what we're left with, Your Honor, with regards to the unprotected vaginal intercourse, is a 1 in 500 chance. That's not merely fanciful or speculative. What we're left with...
That's for us to decide.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You don't think it's fanciful or speculative.
That's exactly right.
Okay, thank you.
Because here we are in December. Next month, Super Bowl comes up. You know, let's say 100,000 people go to the stadium. Under the statistics that we have for the unprotected vaginal intercourse, 200 of those individuals would be infected by XYZ scenario. So 200 people at a game versus 100,000 people there. That's a real possibility. How many people would not go to the game? You have bad weather to keep 200 people away. So we're not talking about a fanciful, speculative, remote possibility. In our position, Judge Dugan, and court, we're talking about real possibility. Now, to address your question or your point, Judge Ryan, if I may, I notice I only have a few minutes left, and I just want to point this out. But Your Honor, if you're not convinced that the statistics lead to a completed offense with regards to, you know, the protected sex, there's no reason not to affirm at least an attempt in this case. Because there's no reason to believe that the appellant, as we look at the medical records, prosecution exhibits 3 and 5, that appellant had any idea that he could not transmit that virus. Was not aware of those statistics. The fact that he engaged in the act could open, it should be well enough to affirm at least an attempt with regards to those specifications. One and two is
specific.
Well, isn't there an unconsented to touching?
Your Honor, he had the specific intent to engage in the sexual act, knowing that he was HIV positive.
Counsel, what's your response to the 2010 National AIDS Strategy, HIV and AIDS Strategy, that was adopted by the White House? That said that the continued existence and enforcement of these types of law, which criminalize HIV infection, run counter to scientific evidence.
Your Honor, if I may, I notice I'm out of time. If I could have time to... Thank you, Your Honor. My response, Your Honor, would be that that's not evidence in this record. As I stood in that courtroom at McConnell Air Force Base, I did not get a chance to cross-examine any of that evidence. And under this court's case law, I'd love to be able to examine some of the studies that were involved in that. Those kinds
of things. Can we take judicial notice of a White House strategy that's publicly released, please?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the appropriate fact-finding would be at the CCA level or, frankly, at trial. So what I'd ask this court to do simply is just apply the standard that this court has set out and has had for decades, apply the precedent, apply the legal standard that the U.S. Supreme Court set out. And with that, Your Honor, it's the government's position that all the findings and sentence should be affirmed.
No further questions here. Okay, thank you. Counsel for the government and counsel for the appellant, rebuttal, please.
Just a couple minutes.
That's what you've got.
Judge Ryan, thank you very much for clearing up the record. I was being undressed up here, no pun intended, for not knowing my facts. But the context in which Dr. Sweet was testifying had to do with some of the high and low speculative comments within her industry. What it boiled down at cross, doctor, what's your opinion about the circumstance? And that was 1 to 10,000, 1 in 100,000. Yes, there are people who would opine that it could be as high as 1 in 500, but my feeling under this circumstance, it was remotely possible. That was her testimony.
Yes, that's unprotected?
Unprotected.
That's unprotected.
Unprotected. All right. Now, Joseph, in 1990, was living with and developing from an understanding of the science that only 5 years previous had we absolutely identified HIV as a virus. So we're working toward evolving our knowledge on this. And I might add, offer this as additional evidence, because it's in the record. Remotely possible. Each and every one of the individuals who had sex with David Gutierrez testified at trial that they had been tested frequently before trial. All of them were negative. So maybe the test here on IRB, is it more likely true than not that this virus could have been passed on? And I believe under the record and the evidence in this case that it could not. And based upon that, we believe that perhaps the best remedy in this case is to send the matter back for a resentencing without the grievous bodily injury aspect of the assault. With that, if there's any other questions, I'll conclude my argument.
No further questions. Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you very much.
Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.